In this episode, we cover Kubernetes community and contributing to CNCF open source project and how to get involved. Here is a quick taste of the episode and then let's get going.
How do you start contributing? And you know, what are the key values of Kubernetes community? And for example, inclusion over exclusion is one of the core, and like decentralization over centralization, and you know, automation over process and that kind of stuff.
This is Cloud Gossip, podcast demystifying the cloud and the people behind it.
Hi, I'm Annie. I'm a cloud native technology marketing manager, and I've worked for tech companies ranging from startups to enterprises.
And my name is Carl, and I'm a cloud security leader working at a Swiss financial sector company. And you're listening to Cloud Gossip. In today's episode, we are covering Kubernetes, its contributors, and the community around it.
Yes, and today's guest is Lucas, and he's a Kubernetes upstream contributor, KubeCon keynote speaker, and a CNCF ambassador. He's also the lead emeritus for the Kubernetes Cluster Lifecycle Special Interest Group and has consulted top technology companies like WeWorks. Welcome, Lucas. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks. Nice to be on this podcast. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I guess taking it from the beginning, I kind of started off by, well, being a normal high school kid and in Jakobstad, which is 500 kilometers above Helsinki, where I'm at the moment. Kind of was interested about this open source stuff, but I had never done it. I figured that Google was doing, this was back in 2015, and Google was doing this container thing. And I was like, what's that? I want to run it too. From there, kind of hacking on different things, like, well, as a, you know, teenage boy interested in tech, it was kind of obvious that you admire stuff that Google does. So first, it was kind of like, they're doing this amazing thing. I want to get involved. But kind of later, when I got to the point where I could start contribute, and the first thing I did, for example, was the Raspberry Pi, ported Kubernetes to Raspberry Pi.
Cool.
It was pretty fun over a summer. And when I started contributing back, I was like, oh, this open source thing is really, really fun, and the community is really friendly and nice. And that kind of is what kept me in that community for a fairly long time.
You've been at it with different hats, as Annie mentioned, kind of running special interest groups, contributing back to the upstream, organizing meetups, user groups, consulting on these topics as well. Do you have like a specific label or a role or a hat that you will call yourself, or is it kind of based on the day or based on context, you switch on different kind of proverbial hats?
I guess that like it's kind of based on the context, but having been a contributor to Kubernetes from the really kind of beginning, so like now, or that is comparatively obviously or relative, but still like it was less than a year old, so it was still kind of marked as unstable when I started. So I guess that is marks it pretty from the beginning, and now it's 6-7 years old soon. So
yeah. Time flies.
Time flies indeed, yeah. So the Kubernetes contributor is like maybe one of the main ones, but actually now, so since now at the moment I'm studying at Aalto here in Helsinki, and it's my second year, so like the latest 1.5 years or similar, it's been kind of on a pause, unfortunately. I worked quite a lot in high school, I was almost doing more in Kubernetes, spending more of my time to Kubernetes than in high school itself. But
that's good. Priorities.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, it was priorities, like, you know, having, you know, whatever geography or something, and then, you know, hacking on compiling Kubernetes, and the fans were just spinning.
Sounds like an amazing endorsement. Staying cool, kids. Cool kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that was that was possible back then, but then when I came to university, I realized that they kind of had it set up a bit differently. So like, although you knew what the topic was about, they still had you arrange the task so that you would work the exact amount of hours they had specified in the credit amount.
That's so unfair.
it is. So that led me to have to step down from as a day-to-day chair, but I'm still kind of following things and actually coming up with some new progress. We'll talk about that later.
Interesting.
Really nice. So yeah, really cool. Let's dive a bit deeper into what does this Kubernetes contributing actually mean. Who are these Kubernetes contributors, and are they hobbyists, or are they full-time paid, or how does it work?
So yeah, that's a good question. So back when I started, when it was like 1 year old, for perspective, there were essentially three companies that were contributing. So there were Google, to the largest degree, and there were Red Hat that were fairly active, also kind of helped co-launch the project. Then there were CoreOS, if you remember those. CoreOS was later acquired by Red Hat, and Red Hat was acquired by IBM. So there's some trend you can see there, I guess.
Yeah.
but yeah. At the time, there were their three main ones, and maybe like they stood for, I don't know, 70% or something of the contributions, 75, and then something split among others. But there was still like, although even in the beginning, there was still like 20% ish individual, and that kind of individual contributor or like. Not affiliated with any specific company, more correct term, they have been steadily growing. So that's nice, nice to see. And also the set of different maintainers and community leaders has expanded, vastly as the project has grown. I would say, I didn't actually check any, or I don't know the exact percentages. You can go and check at it. dev.cncf.com or something. But still, individual contributors are a huge and influential group. I was kind of one of the first hobbyists that kind of came to the project and said that, I don't have your beefy Google Cloud machines. That was the thing they used at the time, or not AWS or anything. I just want to get this running on, somewhere that I can do my host myself. But the hobbyist, group has also been growing a lot. Now, obviously, today, like Kubernetes is, in a kind of has conquered every sector of every industry, essentially. So obviously that also has attracted a lot of different companies to contribute. And I think that's really a good sign that we've seen that the kind of spirit of the Kubernetes community that was like friendly and welcoming from the get-go. People didn't know who I was, and when they knew, they just became friendlier. So that was that was kind of
a good
thing.
Time.
Yeah, that was a good time. But that kind of spirit of inclusiveness has really played a key role of Kubernetes and shape the community in a way that, it is even possible. I was checking the Kubernetes Slack the other day, and I think there's 110,000 people now. So like in the same, general hashtag general channel. So yeah, it's been quite a ride. But yeah, there's like, so the kind of short answer is that, it's hugely diverse. There's people from all around the world. There's hobbyists now. There's like enterprises. There's from academia and everywhere. So it's like it started off with, mainly three companies or something and a few, kind of individual contributors. And now it's just like across every segment you could think of people.
Yeah. The ecosystem has really like blossomed into a huge, huge ecosystem. But yeah, so what do these contributors do?
When I started, it was kind of this that, you know, the people who were full-time paid to do things, and that was mainly from like a handful of companies, they worked toward, they were at the time called maintainers, and they worked towards a specific goal of, you know, making Kubernetes at all, you know, decent, you know, because it was at the time, it was like nothing was set in stone, and like there were barely any users. So like you could kind of still shape it wherever you wanted and at all make it a successful thing. That was kind of first on the priority list back then. But as the kind of community has grown, well, now Kubernetes has users, and you need to, take care of those and nurture like the contributions from those, and you kind of need to, you know, find all kinds of, because like the diversity in the contributor base has grown, you know, a lot. You kind of need to find some structure to this, and so it kind of evolved from a fixed set of, you know, a handful of maintainers, 50 to 100 maintainers in the really beginning. And I was actually one of them. That was a quite of a fun story, because like Brian Grant, who was one of the lead engineers of Kubernetes, was adding me, because you know, it was like he's rewriting all our make files, and he's, you know, doing all this kind of work. It's just like everywhere. And and then he was said, you know, after the fact, that he was, even on the keynote stage, that he was kind of surprised when he found out that I was 16. So so yeah, it kind of, so it grew from, you know those kinds of people like Brian, you just hand, you know, choosing that, you know, you seem to do good work and you seem to do good work and stuff like that, to a more formalized set of like, okay, we branch into different special interest groups. So like people who have the same interest meet every, you know, week or every second week, and they have their own leaders, they have their own charter and kind of scope. And then we focus on top of this, we have elections. So we kind of get this steering committee, which is, you know, looking so that the communication between the special interest groups work, actually. and so the community overall is healthy and is working towards the Kubernetes community values, for example, and stuff like that.
Can you tell me a little bit more about this special interest groups? Like, you mentioned the different terminology, you mentioned the steering committees, which sound to me like they're like scrum of scrums or this kind of PO meetings, that kind of stuff. And then you have these special interest groups. You said it's, you made it sound quite casual. It's like people interested in the same topics. I know there's like a special interest group for security So what is the definition, or is there this kind of a common mold for special interest groups?
Yeah, so, yeah, and it kind of grew out of this thing that the Kubernetes grew so big that, like, at first you could kind of, you know, one person could comprehend the system, but at a certain point it just, like, blew our minds in a way that nobody could, like, actually say that I know what is in the Kubernetes. Like, I know the places where the code is and I know how it works. At a certain point, we just couldn't do that anymore as maintainers. So we kind of deprecated the maintainer role and instead moved to a place where we made these special interest groups. And I'm wondering, like, if there's any formal definition. There probably is in github.com/Kubernetes/community. If there's anything, then it's there. But yeah, it started off also where we're kind of casual, in the sense of like, oh, you're interested in this, I'm too, and you know, like let's put this together and work towards a common goal. That is and kind of has been at the heart of the way SIGs have been working. Well, first you kind of also, before starting a special interest group, you identify a problem. So like, or you know, an area that needs improvement for example, a set of users that need to be taken care of. or need to have their needs fulfilled. So for example, this special interest group for C++ the lifecycle that I've been working on, for example, is like, it grew out of like, actually this time when, you know, there were a lot of container orchestrators kind of out there in the CLAs, but they were doing different things. And compared to those, Kubernetes was by far the most complex to set up. So like, it was a pain every time you kind of should configure it in any way. And like, yes, it's still not easy today, but like it, you know, like, trust me, it was worse. It was worse back then. So we identified the problem of, yeah, like, why can't we have this, you know, easy mode? So like, in some way, at least that you know, you're fine with the defaults. You don't want to, you know, customize everything. Can we have an opinionated way to get you started and to run a cluster? So we started thinking about that, and we started then calling this special interest group cluster lifecycle. Now, like, the product of this group was KubeADM, or KubeAdmin, depends on how you want to pronounce it. And this is then a CLI tool which lets you with essentially two commands create a cluster. So like KubeADM init, there is your control plane node, and then KubeADM join on the other node, and then you have them kind of together. So that is one example of like, we identified a need, you know, a couple of people sat down together, well, virtually, but but still, yeah, then like started solving the problems and having weekly meetings. And at the time, I had been doing the Raspberry Pi stuff and merged that to upstream. You know, then obviously I wanted some good way to run this on my Pis, not just when the binaries are there. Now it's just as hard as, you know, on Intel. And that was hard. So it's like, now that was the next logical step to go and kind of explore. Yeah, so I worked on KubeADM for 2.5 years. It took me approximately like, so I worked, you know, a lot, especially the first half year on making KubeADM good and solid and that kind of stuff, doing, you know, chores of certain kinds, you know, like project management things and like writing docs and like, you know, doing release roadmaps and stuff like that. And then, you know, that's what a so-called SIG lead does. So then people were thinking that, well, you can as well, you know, join as a SIG lead because you're kind of already doing what a SIG lead should do. So so on that path, I was then like a leader for this special interest group for about 2 years. At least so far, it's been that kind of casual growth in the beginning. As we've grown, everything has become more formalized. And, you know, with, as I said, like elections and stuff like that. Because then at the time we had a lot of these SIGs, we also needed to know like who is making the decisions that are project-wide. If we now split up things in the individual parts, who can we escalate to? And yeah, the steering committee is for. And the initial steering committee was these, you know, like the founders like Joe Beda and Brendan Burns and, you know, Brian Grant and Tim Hawking and Sarah Novotny, very important, and so on and so forth. So they kind of built the steering committee umbrella that this is what we do, this is how things can be done, and this is how we can oversee the whole project. And from there, then, you know, they had elections. Some of them were re-elected, some of them weren't. Some of their terms expired. And now we have, you know, since a couple of years back already, we have just like purely community elected representatives in that kind of board. So it's kind of, I would kind of look at it as a, you know, board of directors or something like that. more than kind of a scrum of scrums, because they're not saying exactly that we're not planning that you do this, you do this, you do this. Instead, it's like, what are our values and why are we here? And, you know, like, what is the long-term vision?
Okay. And I think I've already also heard the term like working group as well. Is this kind of used that kind of as an alternative to the special interest group, or are they now something else on top of this kind of sitting between the steering groups and SIGs? Or What are they?
Yeah, so like there's this really good map of that is also in the community repo, which kind of explains each SIG as being either horizontal or vertical. Essentially, the horizontal ones span, you know, that SIG cluster lifecycle is a horizontal one because it spans the node side, it spans the control plane, it spans the API, it spans everything like across the board, kind of, or most things at least. But then there's vertical things which only focus on one component, but very important stuff like the node. Like the node component of Kubernetes, that is one special interest group. And then, or like the API server or the scheduling. Like, so you have those. So you have vertical ones and you have horizontal ones. It's a kind of a crude simplification, but still it's telling. Now, sometimes you have a thing you want to make. You identify a problem and you want to fix something that involves three or five special interest groups, but none of them like actually own the thing. So now SIGs are meant to own things like on a long-term basis, like special interest group, cluster lifecycle, for example, owns KubeADM and nobody else owns KubeADM in that sense. And it's SIG cluster lifecycle's duty to make sure that it, you know, continues to roll forward. So it's kind of a ownership question. But then when you have these things which don't fall under an umbrella of a SIG, then you kind of make these working groups to kind of glue the different SIGs together and find a body that, like, at least they are time limited. So like you say we work for a year or two to find a problem, and when we know what the problem statement is later, we can place it in the right, you know, under the right SIG. But like we might need to just like get people together and actually escalate it to them like on a, you know, monthly basis or something. So that's why we make this kind of cross-cutting section that is a working group. But yeah. But SIGs are permanent and working groups are in general ephemeral.
So actually, when I first heard of the term cluster lifecycle SIG, to me that sounded something like someone who takes care of management of patches or lifecycle of when do we deprecate a certain version of a minor version of Kubernetes. But after hearing that description, that doesn't seem to be even closely related to that. Do you think, or if I'm trying to put this in the context from what I've heard now, would this level of a decision like we had a while back where the Kubernetes support for minor versions was extended, was that kind of taken in one of those working groups or maybe an individual SIG, or is this one of those topics that's taken in this kind of steering group level?
So to the specific thing you mentioned, I'm not exactly sure where the thing was made, but I guess that it was at least approved at steering committee level. Because it, mm-hmm. it touches something like minor version, like how many minor versions should we support? That touches exactly every SIG. Because like now every SIG has 33% more work, essentially. Because now instead of supporting for three versions back, and for reference, like every Kubernetes version is coming out, or a new version, a minor version is coming out every 3 months. So like, previously, we supported like 9 months back, but now it's like a year conceptually. And yeah, so that means that every SIG, if they have something, so SIG cluster lifecycle is, I guess, a good example of this. If we have something like KubeADM and there, you know, is something that we, there is some security patch that needs to be updated in that. And although it's 11 month old code, we still need to patch it and get it, you know, as soon as possible out and, you know, get it to the customer with this change. Before, we would probably have done it anyways if it was critical, but, you know, we, according to the rules, we didn't have to, right? So it's kind of like a commitment of saying that, like, also setting expectations to, say, the customer, which is, in this case, the users, like, how should you expect to like manage your clusters in a way that is kind of conformant with the Kubernetes policy? And obviously, this has created a huge market because, you know, as Kubernetes is moving fast and Kubernetes can't kind of, or it's very, very hard to have this, you know, baggage of older versions to support, it has created, and I mean, 3 or 4 releases, I think is reasonable and good, but like more than that is not really plausible. So that has created, you know, a huge market for these other companies that say, we're going to support you any version if you pay us money. So yeah, that is kind of the difference. But like then they gotta, you know, also come in some money if you don't want to play by the rules in such a thing. So yes, I think it was kind of up at steering level that now every SIG actually needs to start thinking about these things and support, have a longer roadmap when they're kind of making decisions and deprecating features and stuff like, or and adding features and that kind of things. So yes, but on SIGCluster lifecycle, there's been a lot of stuff that has happened since we made the initial thing, which was KubeADM. So like SIGCluster lifecycle does have a lot of things to do with upgrades, with versioning, AJ or high availability, you know, all kinds of these more managemental, well, complexities, let's put it that way, of actually, you know, running the thing and well. So yes, it's been, you know, it kind of started from just like, okay, let's make something common for the installation experience. And when we have that, we can start thinking about other things. So for example, the first half a year, we made this KubeADM prototype. It took 2.5 years before it was kind of done, where before we could say that now it's generally available. Now it's, you know, has all of the features, it has the stability, it has, you know, these things. And you know, the bar for saying that something is stable in Kubernetes, these like general terms or like rules, is really, really high. The bar is super high. So it's like, if you make something, expect that it's, you know, takes this 2.5 years or whatever, at least a year, depending on the thing. So it's a good thing that like the bar is high and you need to actually think through these things a lot before you can't just push them in and say you're done. We started with installation, but now we do all kinds of other things as well. So like, for example, in my case, I started the first half a year of the SIGCluster lifecycle journey for me was a lot about KubeADM. And then I actually got a job at WeWorks, which you said, or well, during that autumn and when I started working with Kubernetes in a role, although I was 16, you know, just randomly contributing on GitHub, I got like, you know, job offers from all around the world and all of them full time and, you know, Google and CoreOS and Red Hat and everything, like just, you know, the management or like the hiring consultants definitely found me at least. but I had to turn them down, all of them. Because I said, I'm not moving to the Bay Area. You know, I want to do my school and I want to study and go to university and all of that kind of stuff. So then the kind of company that did understand, or the CEO that did understand my situation was WeWorks with Alexis Richardson. So the capabilities, but also, you know, that we have to be flexible here. And now this, in December, this marked my fourth year of the collaboration with them. So I'm like, technically I'm a contractor. So I have my own company here in Finland, and then I sell services to them for essentially most of my work is contributing to upstream or contributing to open source. Open source in general is better. So that's what I do. I invent new stuff. I fix things when they're broken, and you know, I manage communities, and that's been real fun. And it was a very good way for me. So for example, instead of during the summer 2016, I didn't have to get a summer job because, you know, I had one already. I was working on KubeADM upgrade and step by step building this kind of SIGCluster lifecycle up together with the people. So starting from installation, now upgrade, then AJ, upgrades and AJ, You know, I'm really satisfied what we, you know, got together there, because like we saw this kind of opportunity to fix some, so the Kubernetes end-to-end kind of story, when you go to, you know, a cloud provider and click create Kubernetes clusters, there's a lot of stuff that is happening underneath. And we identified like three different layers. So one that is infrastructure. So like you need to have some VMs or physical machines that are available. On those, you then install Kubernetes. That is the second layer. And then the third layer is everything on top of Kubernetes. So like, you know, add-ons and load balancers and storage and whatnot. After we had divided them into these groups, we said that KubeADM will do what's in the second layer and nothing more. But if we put it in the second layer, we start from where we have a machine provisioned and stop where Kubernetes is so-called conformant, which is another thing the steering committee also like helps define, is like, what is a Kubernetes cluster? What is conformant? We said we stop there and do nothing more. And that helped us, you know, have the scope in place. So now, you know, KubeADM is everywhere. So like KubeADM is base of many of the like enterprise, say, Kubernetes installation tools. They just, you know, under the hood, they just like exec KubeADM in it. Or if you do, I think, Docker for desktop, Kubernetes, they're like in the virtual machine, KubeADM in it. In Minikube, if you use that on your laptop, then in that virtual machine, KubeADM in it. So like in large, you know, installations on AWS or on, you know, Azure or whatever, Google, KubeADM in it. So like it fits in many places now, and it's, you know, taking away a lot of burden, because it's, you know, approximately, I don't know, 20,000 lines of code or something. So like all before, everybody had to write those 20,000 lines of code themselves. So it's kind of centralizing into components has been kind of a major theme, and it's a major thing for Kubernetes overall, which has made it successful. So then with having that done, we could then start thinking about what about layer 1 and 3. So for that, there's, for example, Cluster API, which is kind of taking on the layer 1, and then there's different kinds of add-on solutions at layer 3. So yeah, we're doing, you know, like at this point, the SIG is just so large that we have like, I think if you would attend every meeting, you would, you know, just sitting meetings all week. So yeah, it's kind of, it always starts small, but then eventually, you know, there's a lot of people that you know, have different interests and ideas and that kind of stuff, and they want to try things out, and they can do that under the SIG umbrella.
Yeah, really cool. I have to say that was a really nice way to view in your kind of origin story there as well. So that was really interesting stuff. So I think now that there's been so much new things, and I think maybe if our listeners are now super keen on joining the Kubernetes community, what should they start with? What would you recommend for someone who's now, after hearing you speak, super excited? What should they do next?
Well, a shameless self plug would would be to watch my community keynote from Barcelona in 2019, where I myself, together with Nikita. Nikita is from India. She also she started her Kubernetes journey with Google Summer of Code, and we quickly became friends in Slack. Eventually we met up at, you know, different KubeCons, which, you know, in a previous world existed in person. And yeah, you know, worked together with different things, and she's really super bright and also leads some SIGs and that kind of stuff. And she was actually now, she also got a job at another Lutze in Germany, I think. And now she's working at VMware, actually. She's one of the examples of, you know, she was studying university also. She got in touch to the Kubernetes community through Google Summer of Code. And now she's, you know, some kind of engineer at VMware and also a member of the steering committee. So it's kind of all the way to the top. So so we had a community keynote, because we were kind of wanted to keep the spirit as Kubernetes has grown. Obviously, there's been, you know, non-idealities and, you know, complexities in this. There hasn't been all, not everything, you know, just goes like without pains of growing to the size of 110,000 people. And one of the things we wanted to do a positive impact was to make a keynote that was like, how do you start contributing? And, you know, what are the key values of Kubernetes community? And for example, inclusion over exclusion is one of the core, and like decentralization over centralization, and, you know, automation over process and that kind of stuff. So it's like, and, you know, give responsibility to the people. So like, for example, I've always said that hadn't Brian Grant made me a maintainer, you know, and given me that kind of huge responsibility, way, you know, beyond my limits at the time, hadn't he given that to me at that time, I probably would just, you know, have been bored and you know, gone doing something else. But when I got it, it was like, okay, now I'm going to show him and everybody else that kind of believed in me that, you know, I can do it. So that kind of those kinds of community values we talk about in that talk, getting started in the Kubernetes community, it's called. But like the kind of recap of that is, well, you start off by finding a SIG that you like, and that is in the community repo. So if you search for Kubernetes community, you'll find it on GitHub. And in the community repo, all of the different SIGs are listed, and you know, it's a lot of information about what they do and who are leading them, when do they meet, you know, all of these things. Then I would say you join the Slack. When you join the Slack, introduce yourselves, say that, hi, I want to, you know, work on something fun. And I assure you that that is one of the best thing as a SIG lead that can happen is like, you know, you're just overloaded with work everywhere, and then somebody comes along and, hey, you know, I can help with this thing. And you're like, thank God. And so that's nice. And, you know, you can build good relationships. So don't be shy when you're getting engaged there, and just like speak up in the, you know, go to the Zoom meetings, you know, are they every week or bi-weekly, attend them. And, you know, introduce yourselves there, say that, you know, these are my skills and this I could help with, and do you have any good first issues and that I could work on and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, from there should be pretty good, I think. If you have the opportunity, then, you know, also do peer mentoring. There has been a lot of these like initiatives during the, you know, every now and then they start a new kind of batch of people that, you know, mentor each other. So if you can get on there, that would also probably be really good. Google Summer of Code is also an excellent way to learn. Now also I know, for example, at WeWorks now this last summer, one of my coworkers there mentored someone in through Google Summer of Code, and now at the end of the term, they hired her to WeWorks. So it's also like a good, she's doing her finals now also, but you know, that's kind of how it goes. So like then you know, they realize you're excellent, and then you have a job. So those are a couple of good ways to kind of get started.
Perfect. We'll definitely link to that talk in the show notes of the podcast. So everyone can find out more there. Perfect. Really interesting so far. And now we will be moving to our recurring segments. And we will start with Future of Tech. So in there, what are the three things in tech that make you most excited at this moment?
Well, this year, it feels like I'm doing quite a lot of different things this year. Earlier, like being more kind of heads down maybe on like Kubernetes and making that great. This year, I kind of have split my time between three main areas, and one is like values and principles, which include stuff like, you know, community engagement and diversity and inclusion and, you know, maybe some mentoring and stuff like that. Ethics, just like how, you know, how can I behave ethically and things like this. And then the second is like kind of secure and declarative and all the good thing, insert all the good things about modern infrastructure automation. So like, how do I build secure automation, automated, secure and automated systems? And the third is sustainability in, you know, all the different aspects that can be applied. So like social and you know, environmental and, you know, these things. Through these, I do, you know, a couple of different things. One of the projects I'm doing actually with a couple of friends at Aalto is called Racklet. This is, it's kind of been going on for a year already, but like just in the idea stage still, like as a hobby, is essentially like I started off by doing the Raspberry Pi cluster with Kubernetes and all that kind of stuff. But it kind of still lacks, it is really a hobby level, you know, like the SD cards crash all the time and, you know, you need to have, you know, switches and, you know, that are poorly configured and, you know, when your Pi shuts down, you lose control over certain things and you can't have that kind of good automation and not to mention how do you pass secrets between all of these things and stuff. One of my dream projects since doing that, and it all kind of built on top of each other, is to kind of close the loop and make a Raspberry Pi cluster actually really close to what is in a real data center. Like at least conceptually close. Obviously, it's going to be insanely slow compared to something like a Google or Amazon physical machine, but still, conceptually, they can be quite the same, I hope. And this is one thing that really, really excites me at this moment. So like we're putting together all the best pieces of tech that we can find where, you know, we're removing all of the legacy things that we can find, trying to have a complete rethink of like, what does it mean to run server systems? You know, have been experimenting with also, you know, some more crazy ideas and some less crazy ideas. And we're kind of going full loops over and over again and hoping to converge some something at you know in the nearest future. But yeah, so that's one we're building, and this rack will be also be physical, so it's good to be at Aalto so we can, you know, actually, well, now we don't have those resources that much, but like maybe we can still get it done of like doing physical prototyping and stuff like that, being in the Sakapayat and stuff. So yeah, that is one of them. Then overall, I think that the open source firmware movement is really, really interesting. And that really excites me. So like, you might not know it, but on the computer that you're using at the moment, if it says that you have, you know, 4 cores, then you most likely have, well, first maybe double up, but the 4 other ones are just in your CPU die is just deactivated because of the CPU lottery. And then you're actually probably running Minix as well, regardless of what laptop you have, because Minix is, you know, like in the Intel management engine, they have like a separate operating system that is, you know, just for managing the core itself. And then they have some other, you know, cores as well doing random stuff, which goes for kind of all of the CPU vendors. And that's even worse in servers. You know, it's a huge pile of, so Jess Frassell is one of the idols of mine. So is Sarah Novotny and others. And she's actually started like a new startup, Oxide Computer Company. And they're kind of rethinking this. And she has a lot of great talks, which I can link in the show notes, about how you think that your kernel is running at ring 0 in the CPU, but you actually have negative rings of negative ring 1, 2, and 3. So it means that if you, well, the you know, target attacker at level, say, 2 can actually, maybe doesn't get, you know, it maybe can't hack Linux or, you know, Mac or whatever, but maybe they can hack the -3 and then it doesn't matter. So so it's kind of, which has code that, you know, was written in, you know, a bit of caricature, but like was written in the 80s and never updated since. So so well, it is not that bad, but still it's kind of, to me, horrifying when she had some of those talks, because like we're building a society and based on digital stuff, and we don't have on the most critical pieces of, you know, on most critical foundation on which we build all of this, we don't have any control. Everything is binary blobs, you know, made by some vendor that we necessarily don't trust, or well, at worst, we can't even verify it was from them, created by them. So the open source firmware movement, I'm really excited about, because there's a lot of reverse engineering, but they kind of take a different stab at this and just like, why is not all firmware, why is not all of the things that we run on our computers from top to bottom open? We can share pieces, you know, work together, all of that kind of stuff.
That's right. We won't want to have another Spectre meltdown type.
Exactly,
attack.
Exactly. So it's like all of that kind of stuff is really interesting, and there's a huge amount of, you know, interesting projects there, like Linux boot and Core boot and, well, U-boot, and, you know, like there's X-boot, you know, there's like, you name it, boot.
I'm sure there is X-boot as well.
I don't know if there is, but like, but yeah, like a lot of these with the boot suffix. So I watched the open source firmware conference. I really recommend the talks from there. They are up on YouTube as well. So that's one of them. And that's what we're really embracing with the Racklet project, and also Open Compute project. It's from Facebook, this kind of foundation body that, you know, hosts all of the open source drawings of the Googles and Amazons
and, yeah,
you know, LinkedIn's and whatever servers. Nokia also has quite a few. So that's interesting. And we kind of want the Racklet project to like use as close as possible to those drawings. So that's a good one for people if they want to look at, like, if you would redesign the server, you know, a server from today, what would it look like? Because like Facebook and these people have been doing that, exactly that. They, you know, blank sheet of paper and like, what do we actually need? Well, we don't need 3 CPUs if we have 1. And and then, you know, from there, like, well, we don't need 4 PSUs in the same server if we just can manage with 1. And it's led to, you know, huge cost savings, but also huge energy savings. So I think I think cost savings was about, you know, a fourth or something, if I don't remember incorrectly. And like energy savings was like a third or something like that. So it's like huge amounts of energy that we just waste, you know, burn, you know, globally, we just burn for that unused VGA driver, which nobody ever uses anymore.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff. And along with this, the second one is like Rust, a new program, or not new, but like a programming language that is really gaining speed now. I believe this is going to be one of the, you know, well, I should not be too prophetic, but like, I think it can have a really, really steep increase in usage during the coming years. It's a new programming language that was created by Mozilla Research. So essentially they had Firefox. Well, they still do, but they have written that in C++, I think. And they kept having these, you know, memory security holes. So like, they, you know, you have some kind of, in C, you allocate a pointer, you say how large should it be, and then you just pass it around and hope for the best. And you can do, you know, pointer arithmetic that is just arbitrary. And if someone at some stage of your code can just like, huh, I can do something with your pointer that you didn't think I could do, then you can just essentially, you know, in the worst case, take over the machine. For example, there have been people from JavaScript in the browsers, you know, thanks to, you know, CPU problems, have been just being able to take over the node, which is like insane. And yeah, so they that's why they completely, okay, this doesn't work. We can't use C based languages, we need something else to avoid these problems completely. So that's why they started Rust. It is kind of a conceptually totally different model from before. So like a C-based programming language or C-similar, C-style programming language that doesn't use a garbage collector. When you want to use a variable in RAM, you say allocate this amount of memory. And when you're done with it, you need to say that I don't use it anymore, please free it. But you know, as lazy programmers as we are, we tend to forget these kind of things, and maybe we don't think about all the different cases that could happen, or like, you know, all the and sometimes you do your best and you know it still is impossible to just grasp all the possibilities. It definitely leads to the best performing software. So the other side of things, on the other hand, is like stuff like Java and with JVM and Go, Python, you know, all interpret languages and stuff like that. Those languages have a garbage collector, which means that you just say, give me a string. I don't care about how long the string should be. Just give me a string. And, you know, while I'm using it, you will figure out how long it is. And the garbage collector will, after some time, when you're done using the string, it will just realize, you know, a minute later that, oh, you're probably not using this string anymore, or this int or whatever. I'm going to free it from the memory now. But this is also like suboptimal for performance, although it's safer. Now the performance is degraded because like you're not using exactly the amount of memory that you need. But Rust takes the approach of like in the compiler, when you compile, you say that now I create my variable as you would, kind of as you would in a, you know, higher level language. And then you say that I can pass it around. I can borrow it to other functions if I want, or I can transfer ownership of this variable to this other function. You can borrow and you can transfer ownership, but there's always one owner of each variable. When the owner of that variable kind of goes out of scope, so you like the function, for example, is exited, then Rust knows that variable will never be used again. So it inserts, when you allocate, it inserts kind of the similar of malloc. And when the owner of the variable is kind of out of scope, then it inserts a free. And then it can do this consistently, the compiler, across all of your application, and boom. Then you haven't had to do a single malloc or free. You don't have to like, you know, figure out those hard things yourself. You just follow the Rust system of ownership, and then you get the memory allocation for free without a garbage collector. So it's kind of a sweet spot. And like, well, Microsoft, for example, is you know, re-implementing Windows essentially in Rust. And like many new services in Cloud Native, many CNCF projects are written in Rust for, you know, ultra high performance. And, you know, all of the firmware that I was talking about essentially is rewritten in Rust. Because then you avoid these bugs and so on and so forth. So that's really, really interesting. I'm still really a beginner. I haven't written that much code yet, like at least not that much good code. It has quite a steep learning curve. But this is definitely one of the things this year that I will look at. And the last one is well, I'm biased because I work at WeWorks, but it's GitOps. So operations through kind of pull request or through Git, I believe personally that the success of Kubernetes was primarily due to three things. It was its community, which was inclusive, and you know, all of these things had a lot of diverse people in it and viewpoints. But it was also, second, the API style. The API style of Kubernetes is like unseen before, and this is one of the largest innovations technically on its own, in which each JSON object has metadata about what the type is. So like, this is a pod. Then I actually write in the pod manifest that kind pod, exactly this version, belonging to exactly this group. Then like, what kind of pod is it? Then like metadata, and then spec, what should happen, and then status, what has happened so far. And like those four things, they seem super obvious in hindsight. Like everybody's like, you know, my kid could invent that. but still, I mean, it was revolutionary on its own. So that, and then third, Kubernetes extensibility. And taking kind of all of these together and combining it with what people use kind of leads to an evolution of GitOps. So like you can programmatically define all of your desired state at a certain point in time, and then actuate all of your state towards that. So which is also another thing we're planning to do with Racklet. You never say that, you know, my Pi should be, you never have a switch to turn off and on your Pi. You just say in Git that Pi power state on. And yeah, so that is definitely, I'm working on a project called libgitops at the moment, which is kind of how to programmatically treat Git as a database of objects. So like not the Git you know, but the Git that like more like doesn't support SQL, but it supports like similar semantics of like just treating it as anything else. But the backend is then Git. So
It really sounds like Racklet will be this kind of magical project where no limitations for resource or time constraint perspective are happening. So
it definitely is.
Just go broader.
Yeah, see, we're just the abstract of the project is like 10 pages, and it took us a year to write. So it's like
yeah, exactly. I know a couple of projects like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
That was a really great list of, in general, in tech, what excites you the most. But do you have top three upcoming CNCF projects that you personally like? Or is it just those general ones? Or do you have favorite CNC projects that are coming up?
Yeah, so one of them that I recently have looked quite a bit into is, which is also, it's not, you know, after you've heard what I've told so far, it's not a surprise, but the update framework is not a very well-known CNCF project, but it's really, really crucial. So every time you pull a container, or push for that matter, you're actually using the update framework under the hood. It is a specification for downloading files. This seems, you know, super obvious or simple. Like, you know, can't I just, you know, HTTP get that file and, you know, be done with it? No, you cannot. Because how do you know that? It is kind of the problem statement is how do you know that an attacker didn't just put the file there and you downloaded it and now you're kind of, oops. How do you know that they don't actually control the web server? But then how do you know that they're not, that there is an upgrade, but they're not man-in-the-middling you so that you think that you don't have an update so they can, you know, exploit you by you not being upgraded? How do you know that, you know, you're actually getting the right content that actually comes from the right different set of persons? Or how can you federate ownership of like different kind of the same thing, but like signed by multiple different people? Or like, you know, how do you know that you actually can avoid all of the rollback or fast forward attacks or like time skew, you know, clock skew issues, and you know, all in all, like the list goes on. The tough paper is a really brilliant piece of work that explains the most common like attacks towards the supply chain in software. It's just scary also just to think about how many, it's just a given. Like obviously that you just HTTP get the thing, you're done, you install it to your computer. I do the same. I mean, I'm not unlike anybody else, but it's just like, as that is not, you know, good enough in today's world, unfortunately, or at least shouldn't be. So TAF kind of automates this kind of thing, and it's a specification for how do you actually secure yourself against these attacks. So how do, and it's essentially a set of JSON files signed in a specific manner and updated in a specific manner. And where it really shines, again, in Racklet, for example, where it really shines is when we have, for once, put in a root of trust into the baseboard management controller, so like the, or BMC of the Pi. So like the say, the microcontroller that is next to each Pi and is kind of managing that Pi. When we once have kind of burned in the root of trust into that BMC, you know, EEPROM or SRAM or something like that, then when wanting to download a file, it doesn't matter if that root of trust file was signed by keys that existed only for 10 years ago. Because as long as you can upgrade and have a new root of trust that was signed by the old root of trust, then you can have this mega long chain of just like every current root of trust file signs the next root of trust file. And, you know, you can the client can upgrade its way to the, you know, current version, which solves a huge problem in the supply chain. Also, like Facebook had a talk at OSFC where they were like, oh yeah, you know, we're using CA certs and we have a custom certificate. So we, every, you know, X amount of days, if we, or like every X amount of times a year, we kind of run into this problem where the BMCs, they need to be upgraded. Because otherwise, if we don't upgrade them fast enough, then our cert will expire and then the nodes won't come up. But that also shows how hard the problem is. It's like, if it's, you know, even beyond the largest hyperscalers to solve this problem, so they run into the same things that, you know, all of the mortals do. then it's like, we need to have some piece which can actually take care of this and in a fairly consumable format. And that is tough. It's graduated. It's proven it works every time it's integrated into all of the container stuff. But it has also a huge potential in a lot of other places. So that, and then Flux, again, like kind of biased because I'm not working on it day to day, but like working with these kinds of things in GitOps. And then the last one would probably be, it's hard. maybe somewhere like it's, I would like to choose just four or something. But let's say just like, on third place, Containerd, Core DNS, Prometheus, and Open Policy Agent are coming. Just like rock solid projects that I use myself. So it's like, yeah. They are, I mean, and it's also, you know, as with Kubernetes, at a certain level, they become kind of boring because they just function so well and it's nothing exciting about it more because it's just, you know, staple food. So those four last projects are like that. It's just like you use Prometheus, you know, for your monitoring, and you use Containerd every day, you know, for stuff. And Core DNS, anytime I set up a DNS server, I wonder how did people even do this before with Bind9 that I've used a couple of times. It's like, yeah, I've done it for certifications and stuff, but it's just a pain compared to like once you've got used to Core DNS. And you know, these things. So, and policy agents, just like very nice to be able to define all kinds of random policies you might or might not want to have for your org. So that those are the like CNCF projects. Tough being the I guess least talked about, which is like why it maybe is the most interesting.
For sure. An underdog.
Yep.
So if you could make any sort of technology reality from your run-of-the-mill sci-fi, from fission reactors or teleportation or proper quantum computing, what will be your only one, and it cannot be one of your technologies, what will be that one single technology that you would wish into being?
That is an extremely difficult question. I guess I don't have an answer directly to it, but for example, like the fission thing was a good one. I would say more generally, like something that solves the climate problems of of today's Earth. That like if it is, you know, we just get all of our energy from like this one mega mini sun at somewhere, or if it's like a set of decentralized fission reactors, or if it's something else like, I don't know what we could do, but yeah, that would be the one technology I would choose. I've been following, for example, the this, you know, direct air capture debates and stuff like that, or like not debate maybe, but like strides that they're taking at the moment. And I'm actually like paying for one of those things to try to see how it works. But essentially, like, they're trying to fix, take a different angle at the problem, and instead of energy solutions, like, make that green, just like start by fixing the problems we've got. Like, it's already up there. So that is kind of more treating the symptoms than the cause. So if I could just directly treat the symptoms, I would. But then, like, what exactly that is really hard to say.
Yeah,
that is probably the most pressing one.
Yeah, but that's actually a really, really good angle to look at it, the question. I think that's a really good answer. So, have you encountered any really good projects or initiatives in diversity or inclusion recently? Or your favorites from the past, of course, that's okay as well.
Definitely one of the things has been the Kubernetes kind of learning from the Kubernetes community, and my kind of, you know, like one of my main idols there is Sarah Novotny, which I think I mentioned earlier too. And she, you know, built a lot of the community values of Kubernetes. Like, what does it mean to be, you know, how do you behave here? And like, what does it mean to be respectful? And how do you include people? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. Also, for example, before I started the meetup in, which we did, well, with Anni and Teemu at the time, in 2017, I think it was December 2016, I was asking her, and you know, she's a kind of person which also, you know, gets up at 7 a.m. You know, or like before that obviously, but like, you know, so she could talk to me at 7 a.m. before she started work at 8 a couple of times, and just because I had some random, you know, in the Kubernetes community, just I had some random questions about like, how do I start a meetup? And she was like, I can answer. and that kind of really, really has kind of left a huge impression on me. On like, I guess that the Kubernetes community leaders also living their ideals has been like a really good, or like, well, super important thing is like, at least my parents always like have pointed out, like many others, that like is not about what you say, it's like what you do. The classic. And that they really kind of followed, and she was really instrumental to like making that a thing. And sometimes when I like, when looking, for example, for our meetup, when looking for speakers, maybe sometimes I was talking like it's so hard to find people, and like, you know, how do I like get out of the echo chamber, and you know, all that kind of stuff, and like how can I do a good effort for like towards diversity and inclusion and that kind of stuff, see to that I'm doing my part, and then also like she's had a perspective of like, you know, it is not all, on the other hand, built on a day. Like in the Kubernetes also, you know, like it started from kind of what you could consider from a outside perspective as an elite in Silicon Valley. It started from that really, really, you know, privileged and small group, you know, white males in their 30s mostly, and then just from there, you know, spread out to a global phenomena that is, you know, as I said, like touching all cultures and all genders and all kinds of people. So also like pointing out that Rome was not built in a day, which is also important for this kind of thing. But yeah, then there's like the outreach programs have also been part. It's not the same as Kubernetes stuff, but like they have been participating with also people to join the Kubernetes community. So I guess that's a good thing.
There's already a lot. Yeah. And you mentioned a lot of these kind of life philosophies that that you and I can take home. But would you have like a specific call to action or a tip for any of our listeners that what would they do to help others lift others who are maybe underrepresented up?
Well, I would say mentoring is one of the good things. Like if mentoring, but also like that's a really fine line, because like if you don't want to assume on the other hand that you're better, like, you know, in a hero, like quotes, I don't know how to say it, but better, higher, whatever position. So like the really fine line of like mentoring
and mansplaining.
Yeah. Well, mentoring where needed, but also like making sure that they get to take your place when, or like, you know, how to say it, like for example, Sarah, the community keynote that we had, it was mine and Nikita's, but it was saying, you know, a lot of the same things that Sarah had been saying 2 years earlier or 1.5 years earlier. So it was the same kind of style keynote, but she encouraged us also to, you know, go up there and, you know, I don't want to do it anymore, or I'm not the person to do it now. Now it's your turn to, you know, like step up and do it. So like also actively kind of encouraging that like you see persons on their growth path and making sure that they get to kind of also step in your shoes, which has happened to me. I'm lucky to have had that happen to me many times in the Kubernetes community, which also has led to like that, you know, coming from being kind of a school kid and, you know, at the time that was not a representative thing. Now maybe it is, hopefully. but coming from that and, you know, seeing those persons actually, you know, living those ideals and actually making sure that I could step up because they saw that, well, I wanted to, but also that I could do it, and then help me. They mentored me, you know, people mentored me on the way, but not like, not assuming I was dumb. So it's like that kind of really fine line, and it's no clear answer because there's always nuance, but some of those ideas would probably be helpful.
Exactly. Yeah.
For sure. And I do have to say that since we've been organizing the Kubernetes and CNCF meetup with Lucas and then the M1 with everyone in Finland, I think we have also tried to kind of take those kind of notions to our head. And I really do remember when I did my first live demo talk, I remember you, Lucas, offered a lot of help to me, as well as kind of just like one day I've been kind of thinking about it for a long time. And then just, I think you just one day said to me like, Annie, what do you want to do it next time? And I was like, sure. And then it just kind of happened. So I think that's the kind of like a really concrete thing to do to kind of push people forward, is to just be like, hey, you're doing this next time. And then it's kind of like gives the opportunity to do it next time if they have been kind of thinking about it for a while. And I think that's really goes with the like living your values and doing rather than just talking about things. So. But yeah, so let's then move to Community Corner. Would you like to give a shout out to communities close to your heart?
So, well, I guess I've already done like 5 shout outs or 10. But well, community is close to my heart. Open source firmware people, I found them also really, really inspiring and friendly. And the Rust community seems also similar to Kubernetes. It seems to, I'm not, as I said, I'm very new, but it seems to have the same kind of values and really great aspirations. I guess I can just like give a general shout out to the Alto community and hope they're doing good things.
Oh, for sure.
That can be seen on like Alta homepage, I guess. That, and yeah, obviously the Kubernetes community just keeps on thriving, although, and that's also, you know, like, I'm not there anymore actively doing the things, but the people that kind of, while being active, the people that were new at that time now have the lead positions, and that is a really nice thing to see. And you know, they're doing things excellently, so it's like I can sleep well at night. So thanks to them also for their work.
That's always good thing when you can actually sleep knowing someone is taking good care of your baby projects.
Yeah.
All right. So today we talk with Lukas Kallström, a Kubernetes contributor and a CNCF ambassador. We learned all about who are the Kubernetes contributors and how it all got started. We learned about inner workings, org structures, and secrets of success of Kubernetes. And we learned how to get involved with the Kubernetes community.
Yeah, truly it has been a pleasure. So Lukas, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lukas.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Cloud Gossip. You can find us from our website, cloudgossip.net. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us at iTunes, Google, or Spotify.